Hello, you're listening to Wartime Memories, recorded recollections of the First World War by veteran William Henry Coleman. I'm Robert Crichton, and I'm your host for the next 50 minutes as we explore these recordings with William's grandson, Alan Scott. Since we first released these recordings last year, we've done some more research to build a fuller account of William's war experiences. This is Alan Scott, his grandson, talking about how the recording came to be made.
My brother has been involved with the Little Theatre at Leicester for many, many years, and they were in process of doing a production of Oh, What a Lovely War. And he asked my grandfather, the Queen Mary's chocolate tins that were issued to the troops in Christmases towards the end of the First War, what did they look like? And we were not sure whether Grandpa would actually answer, because he was very reluctant, as most of his generation were, to actually talk about that period of time. And it just started him talking. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, my father and myself tiptoed out of the room, picked up a small battery-powered cassette machine with an inbuilt microphone, which explains the poor quality of the recording, and stuck it on a chair underneath the table. And we ended up with something like 3/4 of an hour of recorded material.
Because I've got some OS maps of France and Belgium, 1914 vintage.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
I wanted to have a good look at them, Alan.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yes, I've got those over it.
William Henry Coleman was born in Lambeth on the 14th of August, 1897. His father, Harry Coleman, was a harness maker working for Southern Railway, and William followed in his footsteps, working as a saddler and leather worker for a firm in Bermondsey. By the time the war began, not only was he still too young to join up, but he would have been exempt, as he was classed as a munitions worker, making gun butts and other leather items, making it a reserved occupation. That didn't stop him from trying to join up anyway.
Grandpa knew that he was below age for signing up right at the beginning, so he took a pen and a razor blade to his birth certificate and tried to fudge it so that it looked like he was a couple of years older than he was. He didn't get away with it. The recruiting people spotted it.
But what did you tell me that before you were old enough, you went to try and enlist in somebody's private
regiment? In a private cavalry.
Now, who was that?
Now, you've done me. I went to a big office in the Grand Buildings, going up from Charing Cross to Trafalgar Square. Yes. Got me?
Yes.
The Colonial Institute, would it be? Might have been. I think it was the Colonial Institute. Mm-hmm. And they said, I don't doubt you're capable of this, but I'm afraid you're too young for the job. Mm. I was obviously a private regiment.
Why, what was the advantage of going?
It was a privately raised regiment.
There was the pay better, or?
It was all right, wasn't it?
I don't know.
They were all toffs. Mm.
Well, how much did you change your birth certificate for?
The best part of a year, I think. So I knew what I was doing. I was in safeguarded works, you see.
Yeah.
Well, we won't last forever. I thought, well, I've got to get in. And I got my letter of exemption from the firm, you see. We had all of them.
Which firm?
Well, the firm I was working for in Bermondsey.
The details of much of William's war record are hard to pin down.
Unfortunately, we can't get definitive records because his was one of the military records that disappeared in the Blitz.
We believe that William joined up very shortly after his 18th birthday in 1915 and underwent basic training on Salisbury Plain. There, his abilities were underestimated by a sergeant major.
War work, you see.
And, well, I joined. Went down to Salisbury. And sergeant major broke the revolution. Anybody tradesman here? Oh, Harry Wallace, step forward. Mm-hmm. Me? Oh, Paddy Moore. And what did he do? Where did he come from? Told him. All right, sir. Report to Sandra Shop in the morning. You see what the staff sergeant said about me. I said, well, no, what can I do about this now? So I had a good look around the shop, a proper workshop, and I watched some people performing, making a thread. I know it was like cable here. I fumbled about with a thread, and the old sergeant looked at me and must have said, I don't know when you're pulling one or not. But I said, can you make that? I'll try. I'll see what you can do. He said, I picked it like the rest. Oh, I should do it. Anyway, After a bit, I lost patience. I started sitting, you know.
Get on with the job.
I've been working piecework in London. I made rifle butts. I made everything. Riding bridles and reins and you name it. You know, they put the rifles on.
Yeah.
I made those, all that sort of thing in there, piecework. Government contracts, eh? So, no shorting to me, and I've lost myself, you see. He says, you bugger, he says, you've been pulling my leg. He says, well, you see, yeah, I'll give a good report. He says, you'll have to come in. So from then on, you've got me bit.
After this trade test, William was appointed as a saddler within the Royal Field Artillery. An RFA battery would have had a full strength of 198 officers and men, including two saddlers. We now believe that William was part of the 156th Battery, part of the 33rd Division of the New Army. They were posted to France in November 1915 and remained on the Western Front until the end of the war.
I was posted as saddler at Redmond. Then they said, now you get a rise, you get 2.5 inches instead of a shilling.
At the time, a private soldier's pay was 1 shilling per day, about a third of the average civilian wage, although a soldier didn't pay for rations and lodgings. As a saddler, William received a trade supplement of tuppence halfpenny extra.
So you started off, you went to Salisbury
for your
basic training.
Yeah.
Basic. Then when did you go?
I never fired a rifle, boy.
Yeah.
No fear, they go bang. Now tell what I did. I used to see Vince had, I had to go out with them, always prepared for breaking. You got all your kit and everything. And you got galloping all around Lark Hills, Stonehenge, all around there. And the only thing we had on the wagon, at the bit behind the horse, is the first one. Now you've got the gun, the next one, perhaps, or ammunition. Oh, you tried the ammunition wagon, that's what I mean. You used to sit on there. I believe we had a blanket, I'm not sure, across the top, straight on. You've got 6 horses and 3 men up there, and don't do it early, see? You'll gallop right across this grass plain. The bloody driver, someone said, still there, boy? You know, good. All you had was a handlear like that and another one here between your legs. And if you shot off, there was 2 tonne of iron work. What a cannon. So you fucking still there. Whoa! Put them all in like that. Go have some fun with that, you.
Better than if it were in your
life. Yeah, telling me. I could run down the field then with a truss of hay, I'll be back.
I had a feeling that this recording happened after we'd been out for a lunch to celebrate their diamond wedding anniversary. So we're looking at, you know, September 81, possibly the recording. But it was just one of these odd things that a generation who'd never actually talked about family history or their own personal history, in part through the customary reticence and in part through probably the trauma in there that they didn't want to relive, and suddenly, just from a few odd questions, the floodgates opened. And my father and myself, who we knew that we were recording, I'm not sure who else spotted that we got the machine there, but we therefore decided not to try and structure it as a Q&A or anything like that, because I think that would have killed it.
In the next section, William had an encounter with an Irish major. We believe we can now affirm this was Major Stud, also of the 156th Battery.
When we had an Irish major join us, Major Stud, perfect gentleman, he brought his own horses from Ireland. Then when he went home on leave, he was taken back with them and bring 2 more. Which he for his groom one and groom one. He said, came to my little shambles, whatever it was, I don't know what it was now, old ground, I expect. He says, in future, he will tender all accounts to the officer in question, and he will settle his account like a gentleman. Thank you very much, Captain.
He came home broke.
The Irish Major went on to have a long career in the army. As a gentleman cadet, he graduated from Sandhurst as a second lieutenant and was promoted to major by the end of the war. Major Studd was mentioned in dispatches, was awarded the Military Cross on the 1st of January 1917, and was awarded a DSO in January 1919. He was an aide-de-camp to George VI during the Second World War, and died in 1973. Whilst only mentioned in passing in this recording, we're pleased to be able to expand a little on his life.
Yeah. You did.
You didn't bother to save money when you were over there, I shouldn't think. Might not live long enough.
Well, you might have got change blown off.
I was going to say, you wouldn't live, might not live long enough
to
spend it.
You didn't get blown off with £7 in your pocket.
No, that's true. But they brought their own grooms and that with them, didn't they?
Well, army grooms are the rule.
Oh, they did bring their servants.
Major Studd had his own men.
I was going to say.
Being a saddler, William did a lot of work with horse furniture, but his duties meant that he had to work more closely with the animals themselves.
I think probably he was not experienced with them.
You've got to have a horse. You've got to have one of them, or you've got to have a horse. Pony, you know. So as you keep up with a regiment if they speed. all right, me. First, you've got to go to riding school. You're a nice boy there. He's all going round in the ring. Trot, canter, hump! Bloody old horse, stop! Bloody, you was holding on, or you was over the top. Then he'd come and he'd smack your boot and he'd say, kick on the bloody thing. You're not supposed to fall off. I mean, you never seen horse only in a cart. But we had all good horses from Tommy to Lynch. They were the contractors in London, yeah. They had all the massive horse muscles, all those sort of things. Yeah. Then we started getting broncos coming from South America. They're supposed to be broke in. I'm like, kick your eye out. Mm-hmm. All angles. Mm-hmm. God, you know, he knows. Trying to clean one, he got a twitch on his nose and a rope on his leg tied to a peg. Shows you could clean it. He's another twist of his nose like that, make you stand still. And then when you release it, you jump quick. Oh,
that
was life, then,
what?
Yeah.
Most of the horses you had had never been used to
it
in your life like that,
haven't
they?
Oh, no, the wild ones,
they were all
drink
carters horses.
And when you got the mokes, the mules, like the horses, got a bit thin, they're mules. You've got one in, he stand like, looking like nothing on earth. His ears drooping. And then you say, good, not me, mate. And you could push it shut. No, he said, not going. All of a sudden, he won a bolt. I used to think of myself, I thought, well, these blokes on the lorries, they don't get to fun with you. No, they didn't. No, I mean, the lorry drivers out there, yeah, they didn't get to fun with you.
He did leather work, so he would not have been totally fazed by seeing a horse.
What were you doing most of the time during the war then? Mending?
Well, I was working.
Yeah, mending harness.
I was keeping all the harness then.
Mending harness
and repairing.
I had 150
horses, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they would go out on manoeuvres or whatever.
No, they'd go up the line to work. Yeah. They weren't on manoeuvres there.
But, I mean, say a horse got killed, they'd take the harness off it, presumably, and bring it back.
Yeah, you've got to repair it.
And repair it for the next one.
They use a brake tracer, steel tracers, they break them, you know. Mm. They were all covered on the ends, were they? Yeah. There were all tyres and tyres changed up, and then there was all the other equipment, bridles and reins and those bags.
How many saddlers were there then, Bob?
Huh?
How many saddlers were there?
Only two. My mate and I, that's all. The cobbler used to mend the boots. Mm. Well, he used to mend the boots, and Pony used to be the shearing smith, but he had a man.
You were all together,
were you? Well, virtually, on the same unit. A Pony's mate, chap named Ferrara, he got behind a mule or a horse. And what happened? The horse kicked him. You never seen nothing like it.
Ooh.
Up ended his feet. I'll tell you what this same Pony did. He used to be, he's a real company. He used to work in the Union Carters Company, meet people. Meet me, you know. Shooting smith, eh? He was tied to shoe a mule one day. He was on a short, thickish, strong man, very strong. Trying to shoot this mule. He'd done everything but keep his eye out. And he got under the horse's belly and he wrapped his arms round all legs like that. You long ear, bang! He picked old mule up and tapped him on the floor. The old mule's
good. What a body, what do you think?
He used to frighten the French, you know. Because you need assurance, my good one.
Yeah, because
I wouldn't do what I did. When they show a horse there, I put him in a frame. I tie his head up.
Yeah, it's all right, go on. Yeah.
I tie his head up, then they have a stand and put his foot on the tie that on, then the bloke knocks him out. Blame the bloke stick on six while he's been doing one. Just catch hold of his foot and we'll put it in. I mean, some of them big horses, yeah, they weigh nearly a ton.
Yeah.
And they'd change me, pick his back leg up and think, man, you're needling them, you know, get up your long shoulder, you know. And you think nothing of it.
Working with horses meant that William was close at hand during a disastrous part of the fighting at Arras in 1917. Whilst the battle ended with a victory and the ringing of bells, fundamental errors led to a loss of men and horses.
But when I was in Arras, had a big victory bell ring here, with a victory for Byng of Cambrai. Had a big victory. All the English cavalry was cut to pieces through maladministration. The snowstorm came up. All the cavalry came up. You never see a sight like it in your life. You talk about the guys on the road. The Scots guys, the Lancers, you name it. They were all there. We'd been up. They had guns up here. They were all black horses. I did that. And we cut all the wire, the pieces, see, for shell cloth. Clear the deck completely. Nothing could live in it. All the wire was cut to pieces. See? Come on, snow. And officers were some sort of said, get them bloody black horses out of here. Mm. On the snow white,
yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Get them where you like. There's a little broken down village here, so we got in there to what shelter we could to get away from observation, you see. Still no cavalry. Eventually, after several hours, they arrived. Of course, suddenly, in we go, you know. When they got there, Germans put the wire back. You know, them big coils.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The
of course, the horses got tangled up in the wire. Oh, Goldie was in there.
Oh.
And, of course, they got bone down.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make work, he shelled us all bloody like the gas shells. Just to make good pressure. Now, of course, we'd done a fine retreat, leaving Jerry where he was, and got back into Arras.
But, I mean, the story there about they turned up with black horses and the snow on the ground, I mean, the military leadership, the brass, the minds of the brass, if one can use it that way, obviously weren't thinking clearly.
The men were very practical, making things and providing services to supplement their income. Whilst the ordinary soldier was supplied by the army, officers had to pay for their own food and were given an allowance to purchase their own uniforms and equipment. This allowance was £50, 1,000 days' pay for a private, and fueled a mini-service industry among the men, which William was a part.
I used to make a few.
Well, you could have bought the beer, if you'd have won.
What you thought you should make, why not make? I collected their money while we were up there, by working. But when we got back, my mate and I, we'd only two had got any, because they'd paid their bills. Well, the only one thing you do, you're going to be sociable, isn't it? You spend it with them.
Well, why did they give you the money? What were you doing for them?
Well, we made them identity discs. If we ordered the leather from Ordnance, what we wanted, which they sent.
What did you tell Ordnance you were using it for?
I used to use some on the harvest as well. And then every chin strap buckle, you know the old thing, that little brass buckle, every one of them we could lay our hands on, you see. And the shoemaker got the brass rivets. They cut up the shell cases for the sheet brass on the bevel edge.
New ones, presumably.
Huh?
New shell cases.
Oh, old ones. Oh, they've been used. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had our issue of numerals. Mm-hmm. Then we stamped their name and regiment number on that. And for the chin strap up here. And we used to charge a franc and a half. Well, that was 10 pence, 15 pence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we used to have this for paper like that, then. Royal Garrison, Royal Horse, so-and-so. Chappie come, you know, told you, I've got made of my name on some of them. They bring your list along. Then, you know, my pocketbook got up scared of the pig skin one.
Mm-hmm.
He's made a pocketbook like that.
What were you going
to
say? You used to make
one of them? Used to make one of them for 5 francs. Well, the franc was worth 10 pence.
Yeah.
Army leather. Then we find somebody's map case or something like that, for a bit of celluloid, cut out an oval or a square, or whatever it is, and insert their photographs and stamps, you see. That was £5.
So that was a belt. That was about £4, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it's a belt, money belt. Mm. Use all the basils for that, what they call basil stems. They're soft. Hold them in half, stitch them along the top end, put the buckling strap on the other end, turn down flat, just half and on. I think I was, about a little dear and unpopular, but it was much worse than you know. We used to make those. If you polished the Officer Sam Brown belt, what did we used to get? About £25 for that.
The officer class are all employing the working class to do all the work for. Absolutely no change at all. And just shining up a Sam Brown would be quite a lot of...
We used to get about £25 for that. And of course...
Polishing it, you say?
£25 something. They're all bone and beeswax and everything.
£25, I should think.
Yeah, but then, of course, we used to make...
It's a lot of money.
Oh, wait a minute, Grumble, you're saying 25...
A quid?
Yeah. Because they pay for their own staff, the officers.
Yeah, so you're saying you get a quid again.
So they
quid,
cop up.
Yeah. You got a quid for that.
Yeah, against
the ordinary...
Working,
the ordinary squaddy's pay was what? A bob a day? But you're effectively getting 20 men's pay for polishing the belt, which would have taken you
long time.
Probably best part of a day's work.
Then we they used to make all their hunting gear, but they had to buy all the stones.
It's all army stuff, isn't
it? Army leather.
Where else are they going to get it?
Reline a riding saddle, which you very pleased. Of course, that was up. I couldn't get one down anywhere else.
But were they hunting over there?
No, there's the hunting equipment, you know.
What, to bring back home?
No, for their hound and for the horses.
So they found time to hunt when...
No, that was the gear they wore. They didn't wear army regulation harness. They wore private.
Oh, special harnesses.
Yeah. Silver plated buckles and all that sort of thing.
This is a bit of personal pride, isn't it?
Then the martingale, you get so much for a martingale. That's the strap that comes up under the horse's belly, between the front legs, comes up the front with a medallion or something like that, splits. And then goes up to his head where the reins come through. That stops his head from going. Who used to get? Well, I don't know what he's got, can't remember.
When you were talking about pocketbooks, identity tag holders, you were probably talking about a piece of leather which is maybe 6 inches square max. Now, if you visualise how a saddle is made, you are using pieces of leather which are probably going to be 2 or 3 foot square. So what you're doing is you're probably, a lot of this will be done in fact from the offcuts, from what would effectively be waste material, because leather is not something you can recycle. All you can do is use the scraps. And I certainly remember as a child having bookmarks which Grandpa had made from leftovers.
Our fitter, Airman Tom's name, that was his bit. He used to make gold scuttles. That was his sidewalk. The shell case, cut it down and put a loop on the back, make it a shovel, saw the tape on, bullets. Don't know else where he got them from. He soldered the bullets on the bottom for a leg. I sold them.
I'm glad you didn't bring anything like that home.
What? Oh, no, I made that big skin map case, didn't I?
Yes.
Made that.
And the cribbage ball.
And my shaving glass.
The
made that
pig skin came off at the trinket you had.
No, that was a blonde dead officer.
What, the pig skin?
The leather.
Oh, the leather.
And his, grass cellar oil in front, it belonged to him.
Yes.
Oh, we don't need him that where he's gone. Do a nice bit of pig skin.
But what about the cribbage board, Pop?
Oh, I found that in a little village called Bursary.
Oh, I thought
fire.
You'd made it.
That was on fire when I got that. I also got a pheasant eyed waistcoat from that place.
A what?
Pheasant eyed patterned waistcoat.
Mm.
Oh, it's a beauty, that place.
He walked up in front of him.
we entered the place, and it's like a large village. All the street pole lamps, you know what the lamps are going?
Yeah.
Or telegraph poles, they were all burning, but the Germans had set like these one of them, of course, we put them out. And we came to one of these places, and think of a cellar full of little potatoes. Of course, there went the fire in, there went the potatoes. Fall out of the lamp. And of course, I'd done a bit more scouting. I found this old cribbage board, because I'm near the end of all of it, because I marked it in 1918. and I found a nice waistcoat. It was a bit chilly, and a little pheasant. Pheasant eyes all over the world, a real fancy one.
The behaviour of any army throughout history, going back to time immemorial, and to a certain extent, whether you describe it as looting or whether you describe it as salvage, because from the sounds of it, it was a burning building, therefore nothing would have been left. The impression I got actually of the story of the pigskin map case was that in fact it wasn't a made item. He found it. It was basically the property of a dead man, and possession 9 points of the law. Mm.
I think we get a little bit more about finding things in the rubble. So,
yes.
Then we went into civilian occupation. There are no civilians in Brooklyn. And we picked the house we were going to live in, which finally got the best decor and furniture and whatever. And our piano was a bit flat. So we've had a mosey round up the road and found a better one. We changed them over. Anyway, we got all established nicely with this piano and a ding-dong and bang at the door of the military police. Did you know you're liable for looting?
So you had to trundle the other piano back again?
Yeah, put that one back. We got our guns up there somewhere. I can't remember exactly where. Somewhere in that area. We got our guns in position, like a house, if I remember rightly. And we were firing through the wall, you know. And something happened. An officer came along and he brought this old lady with him. And I suppose a parson, I suppose, I couldn't remember now. He said, could we move the gun? Well, of course they could. They moved the gun. And the old girl says something about that they put up this stone or brick or whatever you got there. Not long as any matter of fraction there, and the boys have been sitting on it, didn't know. The boys have been sitting on it, didn't know. That was old girl savings there under the floor. They didn't know all them lovely frakes were sitting there.
No, I mean, Grandpa would turn his hand to whatever needed doing. Mm. Because the treat when I went and saw my grandfather was, oh, can we go and work in the shed? And the warning on that was, yes, but watch those knives because they're sharp. And his definition of a sharp knife was that you could hold a Rizzler paper up by its edge, bring the knife down across it, and if it didn't go through in a wunna, that knife was not sharp. That's where I learned to respect tools. I'm useless with them, but I learned that respect for them. You look after your tools, they'll look after you.
Soldiers were always on the lookout for more food. The daily rations were a pound of preserved meat and bread, a few ounces of cheese and bacon, as well as various meat and veg, with pinches of tea, salt and sugar. Substitutions were frequent, and boosted by parcels from home or anything else that might come to hand.
On occasion we had, what was that for? Something or other prize was a pig.
Pig?
Pig, yeah, young pig. Whether it was singing or peg driving or, you know, gate driving. Something to do with horses, anyway. And anyway, whoever won the pig said he'd got to be killed and eaten. Of course, our cook, he wasn't much of a cook, but slaughtered the pig and we had roast pork. Because that was done by the old oil drum and banked up with clay.
Oh, yeah.
So you could only do this when you were back.
The old shut up.
When it got really hot, then they put the joint in. You either got a burnt off in a second.
Well,
if you'd had a plate of our custards, you'd been all right.
Oh,
we got near one or two dairy farms where they were a bit quiet and sold skim milk. So we'd go and get some skim milk, we'd get some custard back, and but we put it on the forge. They make good custard.
These were the portable forges with the handles, the hand winder on the side.
Then we soaked a lot of our biscuits one day. Got all some prunes or plums or something somewhere.
It was Christmas.
Yeah, it was Christmas that was. We hadn't got any rubber clothes, but we got some football shorts or something from somebody. Tied all the stuff up and put it in the pot and had a boil up. We dumped biscuits and prunes for it.
Christmas food.
If you're carrying meals ready to eat or ration packs, fine. If for some reason they're not available or you get damn bored with them, you forage.
Yeah.
End of story, you know. It's the way it works.
Beyond his work as a saddler, William's general duties included delivering rations to the front line.
Another thing, when I used to serve their rations out for them, because it wasn't very early duty, so I'm an individual. And I had, what, in my section, about 14, 15 in my section, I suppose. I'd been a little more. And I'd go and get what I'd got to have. So much bread, so much cheese, so much butter, so much of this, all that, the other. Then I'd go cut this lot up into 14 equal portions, all of it. If it was a loaf, one between four. No dog biscuit, no biscuit for the quarter of a loaf. And if you got half a loaf, well, I know you were lucky. But in there, it was a quarter of a loaf, and another time with all biscuits. I don't think. And the cheese, get them all right size. And then the Arabs come in from stables. Oh, which is the biggest? Go and get the tea, get a Dixie and tea. It was all ready from the cook. And on top of that was his lid for the rashers of bacon in, which he cooked on the open wood fire and he found it with his hat. His father went down the bed.
Well, the cooking cooked the bacon, or?
Yeah. The cooking.
I wonder whether you cooked the bacon over the floor.
And you had that round tin with the lid. Wow. You got the Dixie in that one with the handle.
Yeah.
Right? And the lid you used for your bacon. Right? And you put that in there. Then when you finish that, you only got the water wash up it because it was tight. So you smack that on, mother, and you had tea next time, you've got a lovely film of grease.
The grease on the top of it, yeah.
These are not tails, is it?
No, I know.
Yeah. I didn't like having this, we have to have a tent. Because you know the bell tent?
Yeah.
You know the seams? That's one man.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Well, you've
got
to
the middle.
And all equipment hang up on the pole.
Yeah, yeah.
So you'll get 14 blokes.
Yeah, 14 blokes in a bell tent.
We used to have those when I was in the old bell tent. Centre pole
took
a fair bit of weight.
Ridge
tents are what you
use. Mm. I mean, there might be fair goats and all hanging on it, all, isn't that? Depends what was happening.
Yeah.
Tins and God knows what. I didn't like them. Last man lights them. Last man, he shuts the door.
Put out the hurricane.
In the dark, trying to light it up.
Yeah. One puts out the hurricane.
Then he kicks somebody in the ear, I'll try to find his place.
Yeah, but the thing that resonates in some of the comments I was actually making during this recording, you know, which was certain aspects of it rang very true to me because I was involved with quite a lot of camping at that stage and we were still operating in many of the ways which we'd learned through the Scout movement, and those rules had been set up originally by Baden-Powell, who was military man of the Boer War period, and things didn't change that much.
We got in one farmyard, we was on the move, we were travelling from place to another, because I wandered about an awful lot of it. And we got this farmyard, and blimey, you've got a lot of chickens here. Well, we were all evil thoughts, a whole lot of them. A lot of chickens here. The old girl came out and she said, "You're a fucking sissy camper." We got messed up with her lot. So he got an army Dixie. He sprinkled some corn around it, and he got a stick just under the Dixie. When old Clacker come in, track, 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 track. Come on, over the cover. Old girl come out of a count up and she won short. That was all right. We were moving, you know, all was getting on. So we bung the lid on quick, tied it all up. That went under the wagon. We didn't stop for 3 days.
You've got the games. That's what comes of paying you.
That was the end of that.
They got a Dixie, big cooking pot, gallon cooking pot. They put some army grain around it and underneath it, and a stick to just keep the edge off the ground. Chicken goes under pecking for the corn. Take the stick out. One trap chicken.
And then it goes horribly wrong.
And then it sod's law kicks in.
I'll tell you this one about Belgium now. Benny Hill's place, already goes. We got in there, it's in a very sticky position. I understood if that was true, there were only six guns that was ours between us and the French gun at that time. We lost two, but we pulled them back. They got an award for that. They wrapped all the stuff up in sacking, all the rattlers. Went up dead at night, it's a wagon on them, away you go sharp. I got two, but we lost two, that's my doctor, and we got them back, that's right. Well, we was in a little farm there, and they'd had to scarper quick because the Germans had caught it. All little pigs running about there. Well, Bunny Moore, she was supposed to be there, not for the pork supper, but I'm cool, put on. He said, right. He goes into his medium shed, Oh, is he roast pork tonight? That's bloody already, Bill, sir. That's where the Germans used to come over their bombers and lean over the side in the basket. See you tonight!
On the mess round, William also had other less pleasant duties. When not delivering food, the mess cart would be collecting and dealing with the dead.
One of the worst jobs was
cooking a long time.
When we had a pretty heavy period.
Cooking a long time.
The mess cart used to go up to the gun, that's probably dead, my wife, not there anymore. And they'd harass him up, the water cart used to go, and all those killed, used to bring them back in the cart. And, well, probably hold them ground somewhere or something like that. Must have been, because there was nobody there. Yeah, Max, here's another four for you. Well, that was empty their pockets and sew them up in the blanket. They're probably playing cards with them the night before.
They chose the shilling
for the blanket. And then they charge him for his blanket.
They were
charging him a bob for his blanket.
But man,
the man was killed. He was charged up his account of shilling for his blanket. Because he's had equipment shorts, you see.
Yeah.
Turn his pockets out and see that we're going to get his back sewn for his. I didn't like their children's.
No.
Still got to be done, so that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. Huh? So it wasn't all fun.
No. Yeah, I mean, but that to a certain extent was the, you know, life's rich tapestry bit, you know, basically, as I said before, laconic, fatalistic attitude of it's happened, deal with it.
Well, so
get on with it.
William's war lasted a little over 3 years, from joining up in 1915 till the armistice in 1918, by which time William was in Mons. It was another hard winter, and resources were limited, so the journey back home and the process of demobilisation for the average soldier wasn't an easy one.
After the war, I'll finish. After the war, we got up to Mons, and they said, well, you've been good boys. You can walk all the way back to Deer in the middle of winter after the November armistice, right across there from Mons to Deer. Beautiful boys, stopping in broken chateaus. And we burnt some beautiful doors for firewood to keep warm. And we got to this place just outside Deer. There'd be a Salvation Army man with us, and a man from Tyneside, Rainer, me. And old Dick West. We all went down to the local restaurant party. I suppose we had enough, I don't know, it was all right. We come home, and we was up in the loft, where the rat stole the candles away from me while you're looking, while you're not looking. Then we went on strike, eh? You did, we went on strike.
Who did?
We just called us. I ordered gun drilled on. Loads had been firing it for 4 years.
What?
Officialed them.
Discipline.
He's in the army.
Discipline.
And the Tom said, look here, Sergeant Major, we're finished with you lot. No, we're only volunteers, we're not on that lot. So we've gone on strike. Then we come home. That was it.
Well, the thing was that the area that they were going through, and I'm not sure quite how far it is from Mons to Dieppe, but it's a fair old stroll. In winter, over an area which had been fought over extensively for 4 years, basically anything that was available would have been used, and therefore you're down to last knockings of whatever is available.
Then, just a cap it, go up to London. I said, oh, you've got a job to go to. God, it's not, I have. I have. All right, go down there. I stood out there on Victoria Station. Dirty great Sergeant Major from the guards come along and said, now spot yourself up, you're in the guards. Now my bloke says, you go to hell. He says, you can march from Grosvenor House, I tell you, though, Grosvenor House. They marched a lot of soldiers, he said, not like a, what was it, Rabble or something like that. The Chelsea Barracks. So we get the march from there, they give us a bit of food, then they said, now, I've had your food, now we're marching to Fenchurch Street. So we all had to march complete with rags, dirt, filth, to Fenchurch Street.
Why Fenchurch Street?
I thought you for a walk. And we got down to Purfleet and to get out...
On the train?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we got a train to Fenchurch Street. That was to get our civilian clothes and to come in. So I had a suit, or 30 bob, whichever you like. Yeah, 30 bob or a suit. I said, I'll have a suit. And back in the day, I ain't got a stripe on me.
Oh, really?
We had to wait a couple of days while I settled a stripe before we could get
what
out.
What's a stripe about?
I don't know.
Things in those days. But I mean, fancy taking them all down from London? Could they give you your gear up there?
That one, the depots, you see, for team up.
Yeah,
he was getting to show.
Yeah.
You could have a
but I mean, you'd have thought they'd have just shown them in London.
No different in 1947.
No, it was done.
No.
I came back from India to Southampton. Mm-hmm. And had to go up to Yorkshire to be demobbed and kick about for 4 weeks for some reason or other.
But yes, the idea, you come into Charing Cross, you then have to march to Chelsea, you know, to march back to Fenchurch Street. You know, that's not untypical of the military organisation.
And then he gets immediately caught in a strike, which is...
Yeah, which I think...
Again, is also very...
Well, which I think was a civilian strike. Oh. But it, effectively, once the armistice has been signed, an awful lot of people would just take their eyes off the ball.
Well, after all that says that, our roll call, the original members
of
the
body starts,
I was 12.
And how many were there originally?
I don't know, 45. 12, the original. The rest were full strength the whole time. They said, how many went through?
The other 133.
But it was a full strength the whole time.
Yeah, well, none of those have been transferred out or. Well, they were replaced many times.
They kept replacing all the time.
Yeah,
exactly,
but all
the originals.
Yeah, but all the others have been killed rather
killed
than transferred
or anything. Out or dispatched or.
Uh-huh.
A whole lot.
The last section of the recording is of particularly poor quality, as the background noise breaks through a lot of what is said. The family gathering is breaking up, dishes being cleared away, and William starts to talk more generally before the tape runs out. Here he tells of an incident at La Panne on the Belgian coast.
When I was on the Belgian coast, his name was Primavera. I took a villa in the basement and bought a top shelf, no fear.
Down the basement, there's less chance of getting things dropped on you.
If you went down the corner of the bay, you got machine guns, so you didn't go around the corner. Do you know Le Pen? You've been to Le Pen, haven't you? Do you know there were string orchestras playing and people dancing? Of course, that's open production, wouldn't it? But as our train pulled in, Tony had fired through the chimney pot off the railway station. That was the first yells they'd had in the war. They were in a rehearsal, so I'm still we stopped there, mate. What happened was, they thought it was going to be a big offensive in that side. They thought it was quite a lot of guns in the chimney. Of course, we start banging all out there like hell. And of course, the water's only a couple of inches down, isn't it? The time we visited the dirty Great Lake. The shells were laying about like silver on the ground. They're so fast, they can slid, if they didn't go, slid all up the top of the sand.
Yes, because it's an incredibly fine sand, isn't it?
Oh, no, it does seem like a dirty Great Lake. We shall find. Of course, that's a washout, you see.
Didn't anybody realise that water...
Well, you don't expect all them brass sets to get into that problem, did you? Oh, you'd be surprised if you say so, mate. I mean, anybody knows it. From a common sense, because your instructions was to, you mustn't dig down more than 2 feet when you build a dugout. You mustn't build more than 2 feet. Two feet of stone brick. That's what you've got. Mustn't really dig, but on the water, you see?
Yeah.
You know, tarp ball and sheet over, your brown sheet over the top, no trouble. Good job.
And that was where the tape ran out.
And
one of the sad things in some ways is I think Grandpa only got back to France once or maybe twice during the succeeding 60 plus years of his life for a variety of reasons. But he still maintained a knowledge and some fluency in the French language. I certainly remember him bumping into a couple of young French girls in Lavenham. This would have been in the maybe in the late 60s, maybe in the 70s, and being able to hold a very reasonable conversation with them in a combination of their schoolgirl English and his schoolboy oblique army French.
So are there any last things you'd like to say about listening back to the recording?
It's been an interesting experience listening back to it. I hadn't listened to it myself for a long, long time. I just wish that we'd been able to do something more structured at the time. But as I say, it was quite an effort to get Grandpa to talk about that period, because his attitude was, don't really want to know about it. After the war, he returned to London. He married my grandmother, Elsie Beatrice Neat, in September 1921 in Clapham. He then worked in the London area for the rest of the 20s, and I believe into the early 30s. He had his own business towards the end of that time, I think, as a coach trimmer. But that was a victim of the Depression, and I'm not sure whether he relocated his business to Colchester or he moved to Colchester to find work after the collapse of the business. But certainly from the late 30s until the 70s, he was working with a company long gone now in Colchester who were coach trimmers. And I remember going to see him, and he was working on upholstery, tonneau covers and the like for a variety of what I then perceived as being posh cars. They were probably cherished cars. In many cases, there were things like Rolls Royces, but also other, mainly pre-war, open touring cars, that sort of thing. He and my grandmother got through to their diamond wedding anniversary, and he died in the second quarter of 1982. I haven't got to know the exact date, but it was on Grand National Day. He'd watched the race on the television in the afternoon, gone upstairs and didn't come down.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, it makes it hard, I'm thinking. How can they go on?
Well, it's interesting.
They go on and talk forever on this line.
You've been listening to Wartime Memories, presented by Robert Crichton. Many thanks are due to Alan Scott for talking about his grandfather and sharing this recording. But we'll let William have the last word.
You could have them dishing out the rum, Mark. They're good. I'd have known them standing on all over the mouths open, so I'd have put the rum in. Next one in.